Before I introduce our distinguished speaker, I'm happy to say that he has offered to answer a few questions after he completes his initial statement. It's hardly necessary for me to introduce him, but let me undertake it. Our speaker is a distinguished senator from Tennessee, a national political leader, a TV luminary, and a novelist. I give you Senator Baker.
Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you very much for the warm welcome and the distinguished opportunity to participate in this program, to have the occasion to make a few remarks at this luncheon time gathering, and then, as the master of ceremonies indicated, to proceed a little less formally into a period of question and answer. I might say, for those of you among the press who have a copy of the press release that was given them by my staff, that I will stand behind that press release, and I intend to say all of the things one way or the other that's in it. But you see, I have an arrangement with my staff that works quite well. They write what they want, and I say what I want, and we get along fine. We get along fine mostly because I indicate that I'm going to do it that way, and they haven't so far successfully dissuaded me. It would be really less than candid of me to speak of campaign reform, politics, and money without relating it, in my case at least, to my experiences this past year with Watergate. That is to say, that collection of events and circumstances that we've come to designate Watergate, which includes, of course, the campaign of 1972, particularly the financial aspects of it and certain others, the investigation of those circumstances, and the upcoming report and recommendations. That is Watergate, as I use it in this context. The committee originally was mandated to file its report, that is, the Watergate Committee was, on February 28, 1974, which by coincidence happens to be today. The report will not be filed today, in case any of you have not learned that first the U.S. Attorney in New York City and later the Special Prosecutor, Mr. Jaworski, both on occasion implored us not to file our report. And we agreed not to file our report for the time being, not because we aren't ready to file our report or we don't believe in our report, but because they're right. We do draw inferences, and we will no doubt state findings of fact and even conclusions on which we may form a judgment or recommendations for legislative reform. And it may be that some of those, quote, findings of fact or conclusions might have a prejudicial or adverse effect either on the ability to impanel an impartial jury in upcoming trials or on the fairness of a trial of defendants or those yet to become defendants by indictment. So the report is not yet out. Some of the staff of the Watergate Committee is here, and they are fully aware of the fact that there are energetic discussions within the executive sessions of our committee from time to time on issues. The committee has not yet made formal determinations of a majority or a minority position, if any, on campaign financing, but you're safe in assuming that we will have substantial recommendations to make in that regard. Because to do otherwise would not be responsive fully to SRS 60, which created the Watergate Committee, which was to inquire into the allegation of illegal, undesirable, or immoral activities or the like in the campaign of presidential campaign of 1972. Now, I rather suspect that we will draw inferences on a majority basis, maybe even a unanimous basis, on fully 90% of the testimony that was given before our committee. It may be that another 5% of it there will be little dispute about, but some. it may be another 5% on which we will have substantial disagreement on the inferences which might be drawn from the testimony. But you see, altogether, that gives us a great reservoir of essentially undisputed fact from which we can draw inferences and try to make recommendations on legislation for the future. The fundamental conflict, I suspect, may be the debate, as you are debating now, on whether or not the United States should adopt a system of public or private financing. Let me begin the substance of these remarks by saying that, to begin with, I think the system itself worked extraordinarily well in 1973, as distinguished from 1972. I think it's a mark of great strength that the political system undertook a rather searching and unpleasant self-evaluation, a scrutiny in full public view, that the resolution was adopted in the Senate of the United States by a vote of 77-0, that every single senator on both sides of the aisle voted to undertake the inquiry, that I think, and I hope you think, that the investigation into Watergate was essentially bipartisan or nonpartisan, and that we were, in fact, seeking to find out what happened and what went wrong in 1972, particularly with the financial aspects of the situation. But I think it's not likely that we're going to have unanimity of agreement on public versus private financing. I think, for instance, you will not have unanimity in your opinions here. I can look around the room and see many of my friends who have supported the Democratic nominee for president or the Republican nominee for president who believe variously that we should have public or private financing. So the cleavage will not be Democratic or Republican. It's going to be more fundamental than that. But I suspect that when you're finished, as when the Watergate Committee is finished, that you will not have a clear-cut definitive answer. Let me, however, try in my feeble way to make some contribution to your reservoir of information. I am opposed to public financing of political campaigns. I believe, incidentally, in speaking in colleges, when there's applause to a statement like that, it gives me some clue about what the questions will be later on in the program. And at the University of California, there was applause for those who asked the questions and boo sometimes for the answers, so it gets to be fairly revealing to the speaker, which is one reason I like to have questions and answers. I believe that we can, and I believe we will, reform our present system of the private financing of political campaigns without undergoing the risks that are inherent, I believe, in public financing. I believe there is something almost politically incestuous about the idea of the government financing, and I believe inevitably then regulating, the procedures by which the government is selected. Politics, partisan politics itself, is in fact, I believe, the most fragile and the most sensitive and the most important part of representative democracy. And if, in fact, those who are the government in the European sense, that is, the administration or the bureaucracy, are in a position to grant or withhold funds, depending on whether one has qualified with even the vaguest, most general and generous types of descriptive language on qualification, to let someone within the government decide that you will or will not receive your $40,000 from the public treasury as a legitimate candidate for the Republican nomination from the Congress for the 33rd District of New York or not, gets to be a terribly close-haul proposition. It's terribly important to me that the government does not have control of the machinery by which the public expresses the range of its desires and demands and dissent. Others will argue at greater length, and I'm sure more eloquently, for the general point of view. But if I were in your position, I would say, well, what then do you offer as an alternative to public financing? Because, as many say, public financing will obliterate and eliminate so many of the obvious and patent abuses that we observed in 1972 and that we know of in previous years. Isn't that the clean, surgical way to do it, public financing? And if you aren't for it, how do you propose to substitute something equally as effective? Well, not only do I think you can substitute something equally effective, I think it can be far more effective. That is, private financing. Not only do I think you can avoid the pitfalls of the public of governmental support, of the selection of the government, but I think that you can make the political process more responsive, more available to more people by leaving the financial support aspect of politics in the hands of people to exercise according to their First Amendment rights, according to their political dictates, according to their judgment. I believe you can do better with private financing, not just as well. So what would you do? Well, the first thing I would do is try to get the percentage participation up. It's a national disgrace that we have as small a percentage of voters in a given election, particularly presidential elections, as we do have. I don't know exactly how you're going to do that. I'm opposed to, for instance, postcard registration. I remember the story, to quickly illustrate my point, Boss Crump in Tennessee. Not many of you here in the room are old enough to remember Boss Crump, but he's a real old political boss in Memphis, and one of his great lieutenants was the district attorney general named Ed Gerber. And the story has it that Mr. Crump and Mr. Gerber were walking through the graveyard late at night, taking down names from the tombstones to put them on the voter registration list. And they came to one tombstone that was very old, and the name was not legible. And Mr. Gerber says, "I don't believe we can make that out, Mr. Crump. Shall I make up a name?" And he said, "No, Eddie, this is going to be a clean election." I am opposed to voter registration by postcard because I think it is subject to great abuse, and I have not seen a satisfactory method advanced to eliminate those possibilities of abuse. I do favor, however, something else. And that is a requirement that the Social Security system come to the assistance of voter registration. That everyone on their 18th birthday, and I'm told that between 95 and 100%, either now or in the future, will have a Social Security number, be automatically registered to vote in federal elections through the Social Security system. That does not guarantee that they will vote. But it does guarantee that the very best techniques for the mass handling of data, for the automatic entry of information, for the currency of lists, will be available from the Social Security system, which is probably the most reliable one in the United States. What else do I recommend? I recommend that there be a limitation on the amount an individual can give. I understand my friend Mr. Mott disagrees with that, and he has a good argument. I'm afraid I'm not entirely certain that mine is constitutional, but I recommend it nonetheless. On the presupposition, as the young lawyer said when he was arguing the case before the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice said, "Young man, that's not the law." And he said, "Well, it was the law until Your Honor spoke." So you see, while I too have some First Amendment doubts about that, I urge that we consider a limitation on individual contributions. I happen not to be as greatly concerned with how much that is as I am with that it be done. And the figure $3,000 comes to mind only because it happens to be in the ballpark, I suppose, and correspond to the requirements of the gift tax statute. Disclosure, however, is the essential and absolute requirement of any reform system of private financing. The present statutes require, as Mr. Statz knows, that the final report on campaign financing be filed after the election, which seems a little odd. And I propose instead in the reform of the system that we prohibit the receipt of campaign contributions, say, 2 weeks before the election, and that we require the report at some time before the election, even if it's a day, preferably a week, so that the public can take account of who contributed what to that candidate and make some judgment of where his support lies, who his enemies are, who his friends are, and how that might affect his judgment and persuade them to support or oppose him in the campaign. You see, financial support is a legitimate form of support, in my view, provided it is not abused, provided you do not use it in an effort to purchase influence. Tom Brayden, I believe, was it Braden or Wicker who had the piece about George Wallace the other day on public finance?
Broder.
I'm sorry, for all three. I apologize to all three. Broder had a piece the other day pointing out that in interviewing Governor Wallace, that he makes the point that many people feel that most Americans and most politicians can be bought for $3,000 or $10,000 or $100,000, and he doesn't believe that. Well, I don't believe that either. But I do think there should be a limitation solely for the purpose of broadening the base of politics and avoiding the temptation for that perhaps 2% who might be influenced. I think only people should contribute to campaigns. Only people can vote. Only people can participate in the selecting process. Only people can elect a president or a senator or a congressman. I don't think a corporation or a union should contribute. They can't now, but they do. Through COPE, through AMPAC, through BIPAC, through the Milk Fund, through half a dozen other devices. I don't think any of them should. I think only an individual who is qualified to vote should be qualified to contribute. I think that would do more to eliminate the distortive effect of special interests in politics than all the public financing and all of the other reform measures that have been proposed. Let no one but a person contribute. And make it impossible for a company, any company, or a union, or an association, or a cooperative, or God knows what else we may think of, to aggregate funds and contribute them in the name of a cause, a group, a sectional area of the country, a point of view, or the like. Only people. Make it totally incumbent on the candidate to solicit from voters and not from groups. I believe that we've got to do something about television and radio and the cost of these things. I oppose the bill which passed the Congress and came out of my subcommittee, on which I'm the senior Republican, that is the Communications Subcommittee of the Commerce Committee. I oppose the provision that gave to political candidates the lowest unit cost. Well, there are two problems here. One, we spend too much money. Two, we're trying to solve it in the wrong way. Because, in effect, I have legislated myself a subsidy. As a politician, I'm saying to NBC, CBS, ABC, or whomever, you've got to sell me 5 spots on primetime television in Knoxville, Tennessee, at the same rate you sell them to the Prudential Insurance Company, who may advertise every week of the year, 52 weeks of the year, and thus earns a discount to which they're commercially entitled. But you see, you've got to give it to me because I passed a law that says you do. And, you know, if you do that, then what's next? The newspaper people come along and say, you surely don't have that in mind with newspapers, you know, freedom of the press and all that. And you license radio and TV stations, but you don't license newspapers. Well, don't revel in that, my friends of the press. Don't you think for one minute that that will deter the Congress if it decides to require a lowest unit cost from newspapers? The poor Commerce Clause is so elastic now that it can do that without ever hiccuping. So I think that we're wrong. I think that we've gone about that in the wrong way. It may be that we ought to have radio and television in a separate category. Maybe you would have federal financing for that, for a minimum amount of radio and television. Because it costs such a huge amount of money, especially in presidential races. But if you do it, pay for it. Pay for it at the prevailing rate and don't legislate yourself a subsidy. Now, my friends, there are many other things that I could discuss and that my staff suggested that I discuss. And it's now 20 minutes till 2 o'clock, and if I intend to get to the part of the problem that the program that I want to do, which is the question and answer, I've got to stop. I see my friends from public radio over here already beginning to get nervous because they have a time schedule, too. They also have a budget before my committee, so... that really was not meant to be a... The only other thing I would add has nothing to do with financial reform of campaigns. It goes back to the question of greater citizen participation, and I should have put it in with the Social Security section. I've always felt, and I still feel, for a variety of reasons, that we ought to open and close our voting places, our polls, at the same time, whether it's Greenwich Mean Time, they call it something else now, but at the same time, all over the United States, and that gets to be almost half the world now, from Hawaii or the western tip of the Aleutian Chain to the eastern shores of Maine. But we ought to open them and close them at the same time, and they ought to remain open for 24 hours to maximize the opportunity to vote and to get away from my good friends of the network making projections by computer that may or may not have some effect some 4 or 5 or even 6 hours earlier in another part of the country. To make a long story short, 73 was a good year. We examined ourselves and found ourselves to be healthy, that the institutions were in order, that they were capable of self-correction, that the country did not go into panic, that we had the continuing resolve to correct and make better the system, to fine-tune it, that we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that America's greatness is truly still before her. Thank you very much. Questions,
the senator has consented to field his own questions, and I'll leave it to him.
The first question is to Mr. Mott.
It's always kind of bothered me, conscientiously, that so much money crosses state lines and district lines. I do it because everybody else does it. Would you make that a plank in your reform platform?
Speaking now of intrastate races such as the House and Senate.
Well, yes, all except the presidential.
All, of course, except the presidential. That, obviously, you couldn't do. I haven't thought about that, frankly, and that is a point of view that I'll take account of. I think that it's worthy of thought. For instance, if you do, in fact, eliminate the possibility for contributions from groups or associations or the like, it may be that that problem would be self-defining, but I had not thought of that. I will give that some thought.
Senator?
Yes, sir.
Has there been any serious thought to re-amending the Constitution to provide a single 6 or 7 year term for the President?
The question is, has there been any serious thought given to re-amending the Constitution to provide for a single 6 or 7 year term? The answer to it is, I'm sure there has. There's been a lot of discussion, and I'm opposed to it. I think that the inherent discipline that goes with at least the opportunity to seek re-election after 4 years in office is significant. I'm not even sure now, although I was terribly sure at the time it passed, that I'm in favor of the two-term limitation. I think I like the precedent better than I like the amendment. I think George Washington was nearer right than the amendment was. But, you know, Republicans were so burned by the 4 terms of Franklin Roosevelt that it seemed like a good idea at the time. Now, that's not dissimilar to what we have in Tennessee. We elected our first Republican governor recently in many years. And Republicans in Tennessee used to scream about a subservient legislature that did whatever the governor said. Now we have a Republican governor and we've stopped talking that way. So it is a question of a point of view. Is there here, sir?
Ask this question. Should there be Marcus of Queensbury rules, and who should write them if Congress isn't to write them?
The question is, should there be the equivalent of Marcus of Queensbury rules, rules of fairness, and if the Congress does not write them, who should write them? I'm not sure that the Congress should write anything beyond the broad general outlines of political activity. Meaning a regulation of campaign financing, of access to the polling place, of the guarantee of the right to vote, protection of the franchise, and the mechanical systems that are necessary, and disclosure. Now, beyond that, I have enough faith in the country and in the people, and I think the people of the United States are a lot smarter than most politicians give them credit for, that the people of the United States will take account of whether somebody's playing fair or not. I do not think the Congress should write a system of Marcus of Queensbury rules. Just for the sake of moving from side to side over here, sir.
Prevent an organization from just directing its membership to mail contributions to a certain candidate rather than collect them and then distribute them.
The question is, what would prevent an organization or an association from directing its members to mail contributions to a candidate instead of soliciting them and then remitting them to the candidate. Possibly nothing, but it would make it more difficult and less pervasive. Possibly you could legislate against it in federal elections. Possibly you could prohibit that, the solicitation for that purpose. It is also illegal, you know, for a corporation to endorse a candidate. It might thus be illegal for a corporation to instruct or direct or suggest that its employees contribute to a candidate. I have not fully thought through the legal implications of that, but even if it is not possible to legislate against that sort of thing, I think it would diminish its impact. And let me go to the very back here, please, sir.
You say you believe that no groups should contribute to candidates in consistency, then you would also propose to end the lobbying by groups since only individuals should have influence?
The question is, since I espouse the idea that only individuals can contribute to candidates, do I also embrace the idea that only lobbyists could be individuals and not groups? No, I do not. I think that groups, associations, unions, corporations, cities, counties, and 100 other groups, educational groups, medical groups, whatever, all have a legitimate opportunity to band together and to express their point of view to their elected officials, as, after all, they do at the polling place. The distinction has to do with money. I think the parallels are not real. So I do not suggest, then, that you eliminate the possibility that lobbies can come and make their case. They simply cannot contribute. Now, someone over here, who was it? Right here.
Do you feel that the large amounts of cash should be legislated against?
The question was, do I feel that the use of huge amounts of cash in campaigns should be legislated against? Yes, I do. I think there should be an absolute ban on the use of cash, except for the most petty cash. By the way, we had a great banker in Tennessee named Howard Preston, who has departed now, and he said that when he left Woodbury, Tennessee, a small town, his mother advised him, "Son, when you go out into the world to make your fortune, do one of two things. Either go into business for yourself or get with a large company and in charge of petty cash as soon as possible." Now, there's time, I believe, for one more question in order to meet my requirements of the radio broadcasters, and I'll take this gentleman right here, please. Here.
Senator, my question is really three questions in one. First of all, do you have an office account financed by private contributions, which account is not reporting under the Federal Election Campaign Act?
Let's answer them one at a time so we don't forget what they are. The answer to that is no. I have a surplus of some, I believe, 7,000. I believe it was 11,000, but now about $7,000 left over from the 1972 campaign for Congress. That account is on deposit with the committee, which does still report. I might quickly add, it reports as a senatorial committee and as no other kind of committee. Now, the other part of your question I ought to answer a little more fully. I do have an office account that does, in fact, pay office bills, internal bills of fairly small type. But that account is handled by me, or rather by my staff, either from reimbursable items or from contributions I make to it. It is handled as a, quote, office account, although it's treated for income tax purposes as my personal income and outgo.
Second, do you know of a substantial number of senators and congressmen that have office accounts used to pay office expenses, and the money from such accounts comes from private contributions, and yet the accounts aren't reporting under the Federal Election Campaign Act?
The accounts are or not? The question was, do I know of a significant number of senators or members of Congress who have office accounts which have private contributors in substantial amounts who do not report under the requirements of the reporting statute? The answer is, I've heard of two or three. I have no personal knowledge of them. Obviously, you can construct a subterfuge against most any statute. What you're describing would be a subterfuge. Yes, you have to report income to the Senate ethics rules, and you have to report, I don't think you'd have to report an office account. For instance, I put $1,700, I think, in my account last year because...
For an office fund on your behalf, then you know.
Well, I'm sorry to say I don't know. Mr. Stats can tell you. Well, he's right. Okay. Well, is that...
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.